You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Reflection on peace. We think this morning of peacemakers everywhere who have the courage and strength to try to reconcile differences between individuals, groups, nations, who, in seeking to understand the history of conflict, prepare the soil in which to sow the seeds of peace. Who put aside their own egos and ambitions, who face factional anger with integrity, fairness, justice, and patience, who call out those who profit from conflict and division, even amongst the peacemakers themselves. We so often deny or ignore the injustices, the inequalities, totalitarianism, corruption, that leads to conflict. We think of war victims, the killing and the maiming of innocents, many thousands of them innocent children, in Ukraine, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, let's not forget the other places, and that festering sore of fear and hate and religious intolerance within Gaza and the West Bank. We're also mindful of the disruption and chaos caused by the unprecedented flooding in New South Wales and Queensland, the plight of thousands of victims of these flooding rains, and all those, including flood victims, who are working to restore order out of chaos. Peace, indeed. But this too is peacemaking, and may decision makers, planners, governments resist the temptation to deny the changes needed to address future flooding and future droughts. We'll follow with 2 minutes of quiet reflection. Today's reading is from an article published in The Conversation, the United States edition, on the 1st of February 2021. It's called "Humans Are Hardwired to Dismiss Facts That Don't Fit Their Worldview." Today's talk, as I've said, is on denial. Denial is natural. The human talent for rationalisation is a product of many hundreds of thousands of years of adaptation. Our ancestors evolved in small groups where cooperation and persuasion had at least as much to do with reproductive success as holding accurate factual beliefs about the world. Assimilation into one's tribe required assimilation into the group's ideological belief system, regardless of whether it was grounded in science or superstition. An instinctive bias in favour of one's in-group and its worldview is deeply ingrained in human psychology. A human being's very sense of self is intimately tied up with his or her identity group, status and beliefs. Unsurprisingly then, people respond automatically and defensively to information that threatens the worldview of groups with which they identified. We respond with rationalization and selective assessment of evidence. That is, we engage in confirmation bias, giving credit to expert testimony we like, while finding reasons to reject and deny the rest. Science denial is notoriously resistant to facts, because it isn't about facts in the first place. Science denial is an expression of identity, usually in the face of perceived threats to the social and economic status quo, and especially if it threatens us. We then seek the reinforcement of our beliefs within the refuge of our blogosphere. Effective science communication is critically important because of the profound effects of partisan messaging that those effects can have on public attitudes. Vaccination, resource depletion, climate and COVID-19 are life and death matters. To successfully tackle them, we must not ignore what the science tells us about science denial. This morning, I want to talk to you about my understanding of denial and the psychological processes that drive it. My focus is on why do some people refuse to accept validated, replicated science, reliable science, when it offers better explanations than, for instance, old religious dogma or prejudice. I'm not saying that denial is bad. There is healthy denial based on reason that is initially expressed in raised eyebrows, in skepticism, questioning, and doubt, which is as old as belief itself. Belief, unbelief. Why do some people deny the obvious in the face of incontrovertible evidence to the contrary? Of course, what's obvious to me may not be obvious to you, and of course, vice versa. Our world, our meaning is shaped by our beliefs, our understanding of divinity, of heaven, of hell, of God. We're all in denial, some of the time at least. It's part of being human and part of living in a society with other humans. And the trick is to find clever ways to hide our feelings, from speaking with forked tongue, duplicity, doublespeak diplomacy, to outright lies. Such deception is not necessarily harmful. We often need to do this if we're to live together in a civil society. Denial and denialism can be as simple as rejecting others' truths because of one's own ignorance or dogmatically held belief. And denial is amplified by the internet through email and social media. Professor Adrian Barton, whose reading I just gave, referred to it as the blogosphere, the social media bubbles people seek refuge within. The algorithms that drive the blogosphere allow deniers the comfort of reinforcing their beliefs and prejudices amongst like minds. This only reinforces their belief in the unbelievable. For example, deniers who refuse free COVID-19 vaccinations and who ignore the science. And of course, the overwhelming consensus of the majority. So what's at play here? When some deny the warnings of virologists and epidemiologists, allowing COVID to morph into more dangerous, more transmissible versions of itself. Well, I'd like to take you back to a little bit of history, and I'm going to refer now to an English Act of Parliament, Westminster Parliament, of 1865. It lasted until 1896, when motor cars were just beginning to appear. And it helps to explain the inertia within government, why they are so slow to act. The Red Flag Act restricted the speed of cars to 2 miles an hour, in urban areas. That's a sort of a slow walking pace. Car owners were required to always have a driver, as you can see there, a stoker, I imagine where they were steam cars, and a flag waver, who would walk before the car waving a red flag to warn pedestrians of their approach. This was not required, of course, if you had a horse and buggy, despite their speeds well in excess of 2 miles per hour, brakes no better. So why? Well, the invention of the car threatened the big end of town, you might say, big business, including a lot of parliamentarians and MPs and their constituents who were all putting pressure on Parliament. Wealthy people had invested in the British railway system, which was expanding at a huge rate at that stage. Or they may have vested interests in the status quo, horses, carriages, the trades and industries that grew up around horsepower. So the Red Flag Act was nothing more than a King Canute attempt by the Liberal Prime Minister Lord Palmerston to hold back the tide of car ownership. Cars threatened the status quo. The investments of the big end of town might suffer. We fear change. It can happen quickly. Look at coal mining, reliance on energy producing greenhouse gases, and the reluctance to turn to solar in Queensland and New South Wales. Ironically, those states who've lost so much in the current unprecedented flooding caused by La Nina, exacerbated by global warming. So in the coming state and federal elections, we need to look at party policies and promises, or the lack of them, by which voters might hold parliamentarians to account. Look at their past performance. Is it action or is it just talk? To quote Greta Thunberg, blah, blah, blah. Urgent change is now needed to safeguard our natural world, and we need to be able to tell which policies are red flag and which policies are green flag policies, those that address the need for biodiversity protection, to halt the acceleration of global warming, and reducing future pandemics of zoonotic diseases, such as COVID-19. And just yesterday, you've probably heard of the Japanese encephalitis, a zoonotic disease spread by mosquitoes. Why? Because the river quality, the water quality in river systems is out of whack. We don't have Murray cod and other similar indigenous fish to take the mozzies, larvae that are floating at the river surface. So it's all out of whack, and this is why we have the spread of zoonotic diseases. Then there is the emerging crisis for democracy in Australia. My big fear at the moment is the rise of corporate power. We now could call ourselves not the Commonwealth of Australia, but the corporate wealth of Australia. It threatens the principle of one vote, one value. And both major parties in state and federal parliaments are watering down ICAC provisions, the Independent Commissions on Crime and Corruption. They're watering them down, and that's why there's such red flag procrastination. The big end of town, who've paid platinum membership to have the year of government, $180,000 or so a year minimum, and that buys them huge persuasive power as far as governments are concerned. So our democracy is breaking down. We can point to other countries and be critical, but we have to beware of the vulnerabilities within our own country. One of the oldest democracies in the world, incidentally. Cognitive dissonance also helps to understand the irrational or ill-founded denial. It occurs when our beliefs and actions don't match up with the evidence, and that produces tension, if you like to use a musical term, dissonance. And then we seek to resolve this tension. It's often easier, lazier, less threatening for us to deny the evidence or accuse the messengers of lying. If we're really honest with ourselves, cognitive dissonance is found within everyone, within you, me. It's usually found somewhere near our Achilles heel. It's part of being human. It's when we refuse to change our beliefs despite overwhelming evidence that we should. We may deny the evidence. This denial will then likely morph into things like conspiracy theories. Look at the cartoon. Sometimes conspiracies may be justified. Let's not be like the sheep in this cartoon. The smart sheep on the left suspects teamwork between man and dog. In this case, though, it's the majority who are denying it. We are always wise to listen to warnings. The danger might be real, but to rebut the arguments when there's lack of evidence. Sometimes those who oppose the consensus of the majority end up by being our heroes. We need skeptics, we need skepticism, but skepticism based on strong, rational, scientific evidence, not prejudice. My simple definition of prejudice, of course, I've given it to you before, being down on something we're not up in. Cognitive dissonance was a phenomenon first described by an American psychologist, Leon Festinger, in his classic 1957 study, When Prophecy Fails. Leon had read a story in a local newspaper headlined, Prophecy from the Planet Clarion, Call to City, Flee That Flood. It was a doomsday prediction by one Dorothy Martin, the leader of a doomsday cult called the Seekers. Dorothy was a Chicago housewife who had reinvented herself as a guru. She'd claimed to be a messenger for an alien extraterrestrial life form she called the Guardians, whose leader, Sananda, she claimed, was a reincarnation of Jesus. Sananda would guide her hand, shaking theatrically in front of the assembled throng, to write his messages. This reincarnated Jesus guided Dorothy's handwriting to prophesy that a catastrophic global flood was about to destroy a sinful world. But those who joined the Seekers would be rescued from the flood by the Guardians in flying saucers. So Leon and his two collaborators set about infiltrating Dorothy's group in a way that would probably not be approved by ethics committees today. The voices Dorothy kept hearing were perhaps symptomatic of a developing schizophrenia, I think. She'd also begun to visit New Age events, and it was at one of these she met Dr. Charles Larhead, a former Christian missionary obsessed about UFOs. He was working on the student health staff at Michigan State University, and being a medical man, Charles gave Dorothy and the Seekers greater credibility, and he used his position to recruit others, particularly the more impressionable students, into the cult. Dorothy's pictured here with him. Together they concocted a hodgepodge belief system that combines selective elements of Christianity, Scientology, and Atomic Age sci-fi. However, Sananda's messages through Dorothy suddenly became more threatening and ominous as she sought to build faith amongst her followers and recruit more members to the Seekers. After all, we know that fear hastens conversion, doesn't it? And commitment from doubters who soon become believers. Doomsday was rapidly approaching, but when? The neighbourhood soon got to hear about this impending doomsday. Children would come knocking on Dorothy's door. Are you the lady who believes in aliens? Parents began to complain to police. Then word reached Michigan State University and Dr. Larhead was sacked from his job in student health for upsetting students about predictions of the end of the world. But what did it matter, really, with impending doomsday? The Seekers began to leave their jobs and family in order to ready themselves for doomsday. Dorothy's long-suffering husband's concerns grew when her two earlier prophecies came to nothing. But Dorothy, undeterred, was able to explain them away. Some Seekers left, but ironically, 12 faithful disciples remained. Her third and penultimate prophecy from Sananda was for a doomsday rescue at the stroke of midnight on December the 22nd. But this third prophecy also came to nothing. By now, the Seekers, however, had got the attention of the media, and the Chicago newspapers could already sense a surge in their readership. Then Dorothy had another fourth message. It said that Doomsday and the flood rescue would occur on Christmas Eve, December the 24th, 1954. And as night fell, the remaining 12 seekers gathered on Dorothy's front lawn. They were joined by a crowd of 200 voyeuristic onlookers who had read about the prophecy and gathered to watch all the commotion. The seekers then began screaming Christmas carols to the heavens to bring the guardians to their rescue. After 20 minutes, the prophecy failed for the fourth time, and the seekers retreated back into Dorothy's house, disappointed but still faithful. According to Dorothy, it was just another test by Sananda. By now, that created a public nuisance and a warrant was issued for Dorothy's arrest. Anyway, Dorothy and her long-suffering husband, who I haven't mentioned yet, still sticking by her, he must have loved her, fled to Arizona, and reinventing herself once more and still full of self-belief, she renamed herself Dorothy Keach and then Sister Thedra. She founded two more cults, the Order of Sananda and Sanat Kumara, the name she'd given to two of the guardians. Dorothy, alias Dorothy Keach, alias Sister Thedra, died aged 92 in 1992. Her offsider, Dr. Lahed, made a living by pushing his beliefs in UFOs at various conferences around America. So, while none of Dorothy's prophecies came to fruition, the Festinger study of cognitive dissonance helps us to understand denial. How it's possible, despite repeatedly failed prophecies, to still hold on to beliefs. Festinger realised that the seekers had defined themselves by their beliefs. We all do it. The time and energy we spend in our emotional and psychological commitment define us. They define who we are, and we relinquish these beliefs very reluctantly. Any questioning, doubting, or renunciation is psychologically unacceptable, and denial is the outcome. It's resolved by denying that which challenges our being. Human belief and faith is built on it. Denial is the defence mechanism that protects who believers are, have become, or might become. This is the psychology of denial. And just if you think this can only happen in America, do you remember back? I'll take you back to the Adelaide summer of 1976. Don Dunstan was facing a lower house election the following year. It's only ever happened once without the election of the upper house, 1977. He was worried about a conservative backlash to his policies because the state Labor government had begun debating Aboriginal rights, challenging the White Australia policy, and proposing legislation to decriminalise homosexuality. John Nash, a fundamentalist Christian and amateur clairvoyant, had prophesied that Adelaide would be inundated by a huge tidal wave as retribution by God on our city of sin. But instead of fleeing to the safety of the hills, the 2,000 or so sceptics that Don is waving to here were all in cheerful denial over John Nash's prophecy. He predicted that Doomsday would be somewhere between, not as accurate as Dorothy, 10:30 a.m. and noon on the 19th of January, 1976. John Nash was so confident of his prophecy that he sold his house and moved to a Victorian country town. I'm pleased to say that he was originally from Victoria. The Murdoch press, like the Chicago press with Dorothy Martin Seekers, saw John Nash's doomsday prediction as a godsend. Rupert had taken over the Adelaide News in 1954. The year he began building News Corp into the global empire it is today. Who would have thought? The news got hold of the story and amplified it, giving it credibility, especially in the eyes of vulnerable, impressionable people who at that time might have believed anything that was written in the paper. But it says so in the paper, I remember them saying, as if it gave Nash's prophecy the stamp of authenticity. The exposure caused there are always vulnerable people. It caused panic, particularly amongst new and non-English speaking people, migrants. Some sold their properties and moved out of the city. Beachfront properties were sold at bargain prices. Hotels in the area reported a drop of 75% in customers. And those working in seaside businesses and in the hospitality industry took a sickie. Some parents kept their children home from school, and others drove to the Adelaide Hills with all their possessions to escape the flood, some driving as far as the Riverland, just to be sure. Perhaps they had rallies there. It was just the story Rupert and the news needed to sell more newspapers in the midsummer somnolence of sleepy Adelaide. I remember Don Dunstan trying to diffuse the hysteria that had built up amongst the impressionable souls. The news and the truth, remember the truth? The scandal were the closest things that Adelaide had to social media in the mid-70s, especially when Don's deputy, Des Corcoran, in a misreported interview, no doubt with nefarious motive, had appeared to give Nash's prophecy some credence. There were winners from the Nash prophecy. Nash's prophecy and the publicity by News Corp-controlled media gave Don Dunstan valuable political publicity and credibility before the 1977 lower house elections. And Adelaide had suddenly burst onto the world media stage. The BBC flew a TV crew from London to Glenelg to film the impending catastrophe. And a Sydney radio station also sent their entire morning program staff for a live, on-the-spot broadcast. Imagine that. When the morning of the Nash tidal wave prophecy arrived, a couple of thousand deniers headed to the beach. Some cheekily carried banners calling for everybody to repent their sins as the end was nigh. Some in bathers, flippers and goggles, some with surfboards or bodyboards under their arms, came to surf up to Mount Lofty, the only chance they would ever have to do it. One wag, dressed formally in coat and tails, announced that he would go in style. Then Don arrived to do a King Canute and turn back the tide, reassuring the gathering multitude that there would be no disaster. And he received a warm cheer from the crowd when he said that Mr. Nash was no longer welcome back in Adelaide. It augured well for a Labor victory in the 1977 House of Assembly election. Predictably, there was no tidal wave. The crowds began to wander off home, some to the nearest bar, others took advantage of the summer weather and stayed at the beach for the day. Next morning, the editorial in the Advertiser, already partially owned by Sir Keith Murdoch, Rupert's father, before it was fully taken over by Rupert's News Corp, in 1987, said this: "Hopefully the lesson we should all have learnt from yesterday's pathetic anticlimax is to rely more on our common sense and less on the silly and unscientific speculation of self-appointed soothsayers." Now, this was somewhat disingenuous, as both papers had given credibility to the Nash protection just by reporting it, and knowing that this would also boost circulation. Has the media changed? I think it's got worse. In conclusion, the greatest mysteries to me are the intelligence found within nature, species that have been around for a lot longer than we have, all nurtured and sustained by shared but diminishing biodiversity. And there's the spiritual mystery of the human soul, which we explore through our languages, stories, literature, poetry. It's allowed us to explore and define the nature of God and to wonder at the divinity around and within us, a divinity that, to me, is expressed in love in all its forms. For it is the miracle of our loving and in our being loved that I see the face of God. Now, you may have watched Thursday's foreign correspondent trapped in Idlib. Did you see that? It's about the plight of refugees and the forgotten civil war in Syria being waged by Bashar Assad. What a name. Who is full of the same self-justification and self-entitlement as his ally and comrade in arms, Vladimir Putin. Yet out of the evil of the Assad regime is to be found the miracle of Alam. Alam's a Syrian mother, a refugee in the huge refugee camp at Idlib. Alam and her family have lost their home and possessions, yet Alam organises food and warm clothing for refugees and toys for their children as they await the remote possibility of being able to flee across the border into the refuge of neighbouring Turkey. Then there is the mystery of a universe as unfathomable as the human mind, and a challenge to those fundamentalists who deny the science and see the creation story in Genesis as written by the Almighty himself. I had a man call knocking at my door, selling religion, and he was quite sure that the only book you ever needed to ever read was the Bible. There's still a place for beliefs and stories that science will never fully explain. We must have the compassion and the acceptance to understand why people deny the science. Our beliefs determine how we make sense of the world and how we define and shape our lives and try to live them as best we can. Life is a journey towards truth, and truth, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder. We also need the humility to accept that even our best science may one day be relegated to the pages of all the ancient mythology that preceded it, and which also has meaning and wisdom, let's not forget. There will always be mystery and hope. It's what energises science, philosophy, theology, literature, and indeed all the arts, and all the other disciplines that contribute to our understanding of nature and that part of it which is us. So let's embrace the modern wisdoms of our seven principles, rather than merely pay lip service to them. Kierkegaard said, "The function of prayer is not to influence God, but rather to change the nature of the one who prays." And like prayer, our seven principles only become useful when we embrace the action implied within each of them. Our seventh principle encircles and embraces the other six quite wisely. I'm bold enough to suggest that it needs more than respect for the web of all existence. It also needs action to secure the web of life, of all existence, on this still beautiful blue planet of ours. So let's act in whatever way we can, rather than wave the red flag of ignorance, self-interest, inertia and apathy, all leading us to denial. And whenever our favourite, often long-held beliefs and answers, those that have hitherto defined us, are questioned by better answers, well, let's embrace them too and resist the temptation to deny. For that's the way we will all grow. Amen. And so we come to our offering. This epicormic shoot from one of our largest and healthiest eucalyptus obliqua trees at Shady Grove, recovering from the so-called cool burn, is a symbol of spiritual growth and regeneration within this Unitarian community. The search for a new minister promises a new era, new opportunities to grow like this fresh green shoot, and we need your generous financial and practical support. You're reminded that there's a pay point in the foyer on the way out of the church, and there's also a bowl for loose collection. You might also like to consider a direct debit arrangement, and regular giving will help us to plan more effectively. See Helen Hall about that. Your support will help this church to respond to personal and community need in these challenging times and will be much appreciated.
We hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitariansa@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.